From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Henry Mancini. The composer who gave us the themes from Peter Gunn and Breakfast at Tiffany's has a new score for the new film, The Glass Menagerie. Also today, I talk with adventure writer Tim Cahill. He's scaled mountains, tracked grizzlies, and flown into the eye of a hurricane. He's done all that and was scared every minute of it. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new reissue of Tchaikovsky's Last Three Symphonies. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses industries that intentionally use words that don't mean what they say. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Okay, let's play Name That Tune. I bet you can name this tune in four notes. The correct answer is The Pink Panther, and it's one of the many themes my guest Henry Mancini is famous for. From TV, there's his themes for Peter Gunn and Mr. Lucky, which introduced a lot of baby boomers to jazz. More recently, he wrote TV themes for Newhart Hotel and Remington Steele. Then there are his movie themes, The Days of Wine and Roses and Breakfast at Tiffany's, whose title song was Moon River. Mancini also wrote the scores for the films A Touch of Evil, A Shot in the Dark, Victor Victoria, Ten, and Blind Date, along with hundreds of others. He's won 4 Oscars and 20 Grammys. His latest credit is the score for the new film The Glass Menagerie, Paul Newman's adaptation of the Tennessee Williams drama. Henry Mancini is joining us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. Before we meet him, let's listen to an excerpt of his score for The Glass Menagerie. How did you get to score the Paul Newman remake of Glass Menagerie?
Well, I had done this is my 5th project with Paul. I had started with Sometimes a Great Notion, and we'd done Shadow Box, A Harry and Son, and another thing. And so it was a matter of having worked with him a good bit, and Paul called me and asked me to do it.
Did he give you any idea of what he was looking for musically?
Yeah. One thing he said, I don't want any violins. So right away, I saw where he was headed. You know.
What did that say to you?
Well, it said to me that he didn't want. I think he was aiming at more of a chamber kind of a score. We did use we used a double string quartet, but you could never really tell that by it never gave the impression of a big so-called. What would you say? Hollywood score. No, it was a double quartet, woodwinds and woodwinds and a couple of keyboards. So it was kind of small scale. That's what he was saying, and I think it was his instinct was exactly right.
Did you want to go back to the 1950 film with Jane Wyman and look at the score that they used?
No. No.
Intentionally avoid it?
I had no desire to. I don't even know who did that score. One thing I did listen to, well, it came with the script, was the... You see, there was a stage score that wasn't very much. It was just a few... I used one theme out of that score by Paul Bowles. It's on the album, too. It's Jonquils or something like that. You know, it's actually Joanne Woodward's theme, the mother theme in the picture. So I'd heard that, and I picked that one out to use because Joanne liked it very much, and she had done the show on the stage so often that she kind of felt comforted, you know, in hearing something that she remembered.
I'd like to go back to the beginning of your career in Hollywood. You started off in the early 1950s at Universal, and I guess you were on contract there, and from the way I understand it, you did about 100 films. One of those films was Touch of Evil, which is directed by Orson Welles, one of the real great films. Did you do a lot of schlock also?
Well, it was mostly schlock.
Was it?
It was mostly, we had everything there. I did, well, let me put it this way. I was there 6 years, and Universal during that time made around 50 pictures a year. So that number of 100 is quite under what the real figure would be. But we had all kinds of stuff. Westerns, these old Rory Calhoun Westerns. Ma and Pa Kettle, Francis the Mule, Bonzo the Ape, stuff like that. In addition, well, I got about two or three good pictures while I was there. The Glenn Miller story was another one.
Did you have to learn all the Hollywood cliches of the period?
Yeah, that was the best part. What do you mean of the period? They're still around. Yeah, there's no period. I did. I've said that in the past. Learning the cliches was most fun of all, just to know that you could do what the big boys were doing at the time. But that's true. And in doing that, you get that all out of your system. You have attacks of it once in a while sometimes.
Can you describe some of the cliches that you had to learn? Like, was there a certain kind of sound to go for to bring tears to people's eyes and something else that you'd have to use for a Rory Calhoun Western?
Yeah, well, it was the day of the overstated villain and overstated, I would say, you know, because every time my boss during those years was Joe Gershenson, who was a marvelous man and very astute dramatically, he was a street guy from New York, and he had a very succinct way. He called it, you know, when you have like the villain appears, he'd say, "I want a jig-a-jig there," and a jig-a-jig was something like that, you know. And then, of course, the outdoor themes, and it was fun. I really got a kick out of it.
Can you use those cliches now?
If called for, yeah, it depends. You have to be very careful, though. You know, people have to know you have your tongue in your cheek, or else they say, "What's that old fogey doing up there?" You know.
My guest is composer Henry Mancini. Now, the theme that you wrote that really made you famous to everybody in America was the theme from Peter Gunn, which was the TV detective show that started in, I think it was 1958. And
right.
he was, I guess, one of the first really cool private eyes on television. It was a jazz theme. Why did you decide to go with a jazz theme for the show?
Well, Blake Edwards, you know, was the writer, producer, director of that series. And he set up a club. I don't know whether some of the younger people in the audience have seen the show recently. It's still on. It's still going on.
Yeah,
all
in reruns.
Place.
Yeah, yeah. You're talking about the club Mothers, the nightclub.
Mothers, yes. Mothers, which was very risque at the time to call the place Mothers, you know. And it was a jazz club. And so I took the cue from that. And it just seemed a very natural thing to do. And Blake didn't really point me in any direction. He just said, "Here, do it." And that's what came out. And at the time, you remember, that was a period of the West Coast cool jazz. And we had all the great guys out here, of that school who were playing, you know, among them Larry Bunker, Shelly Mann. We had a marvelous band on that show. So the jazz spilled over into the scoring, and I think it worked pretty well.
Could I ask you to describe what was in your mind when you wrote the score, the sound that you were going for?
Well, first of all, you have to separate the theme from the score. If you notice, the theme has really nothing to do with jazz. The theme I wrote because I said, now, Peter Gunn, what am I going to do here? I have to have something that's going to get their attention right away. And this ostinato bass came in, you know, and it sounded very powerful in the low, in with the guitar and the bass and the piano playing, boom, 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 boom. And that was another thing. That was, I think, the secret of the success of that piece was the fact that it was 8 to the bar, which indicated rock and roll. And as you know, there have been many records. Jimi Hendrix recorded it. The Art of Noise did it last year. And all along the way, there have been many, many recordings by the rock people. It's a punk favorite, too.
I know. Well, yeah. I'm going to play your recording of it from an album that you made of the theme. And this is Henry Mancini's theme from Peter Gunn. That really does still sound great.
Thank you.
Do you ever still listen to it?
No, not much. I don't. I listen to my things right after I make them. Albums, or if it's a movie, I'll look at it. And whatever I do, I just do them, and then I file them away. And I rarely, unless I come across it, of course, in. On the radio, or I'm looking at TV, and I happen to pass a station, pass a channel that is playing a picture.
You know, a friend of mine who used to watch Peter Gunn all the time, still does on reruns, says that he grew up always wanting to be followed around by a walking bass line like Peter Gunn was.
Yeah, well, you know something, the walking bass in television, anyhow, or in scoring, has become. Is a cliche of that period, you know. But at that time, it hadn't been used that much, and it's the greatest thing for sustaining any kind of a line or an emotion. You do it slow, it has another effect. You do it fast, and you get very exciting music from it. I think that was the key, that opening bass line, yeah, now that I think about it.
You know, TV themes were almost like folk music for people who grew up in the 1950s. It was the soundtrack for your life in a way, and you heard the same song over week after week at the same time. So I think you really profoundly influenced a lot of people who grew up in the 1950s.
Yes, thank you.
When you wrote the Pink Panther theme, did you intend that as almost a parody of the Peter Gunn theme?
No. It had nothing to do. It was a different kind of... in fact, the Pink Panther was much more jazz than Peter Gunn. It had a different feeling to it, of course, but it was just a theme that I had written for the David Niven character, the Phantom, you know, in the play, in the movie. And it just happened. I had no idea when I wrote that theme, which I wrote very quickly, by the way. It just came out. It was like a rush. But I had written that for David Niven, who played the Phantom. And when Blake told me he was going to have a... cartoon, animated feature, not feature, animated cartoon at the beginning, I said, well, gee, I said to myself, well, I've already written that. So I just adapted it and made it fit in with all of the things that they did on the screen.
I just want to play a little taste of the theme that you wrote for the Pink Panther. I think that you're one of the composers who really helped forge that link between crime stories and jazz themes. And then there was a period, I think, where jazz was used much less, on television especially, for crime themes and for detective themes.
Yeah. Well, in movies, you know, jazz had been used mostly, strangely enough, it's sadly enough, pictures that had sleazy backgrounds or had dope or, you know, had drinking or something of that sort. It was always attached to that. It had that stigma to it. And I was happy at Peter Gunn that I was able to inject some humor, which, of course, you know, jazz can be very humorous if used in the right way.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your composing and about how you compose for movies. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is composer Henry Mancini. His latest project is the score for the new film, The Glass Menagerie, directed by Paul Newman. We'll talk more about Henry Mancini's work after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Composer Henry Mancini is my guest. You were telling us earlier that in the early 50s, you were really called on to use a lot of the cliches for the movies that you did. Now, you're still doing a lot of movies, and I think that perhaps the way movie music is used has changed. Do you find that there is less underscoring required now in movies, that there's more periods where there's no music in the background?
I don't know that that's true. You know, there's... When you get to the big pictures, you know, that started with the Star Wars kind of score that Johnny Williams did, then you've got wall-to-wall music. So in that instance, and all of those pictures that followed, all of the Star Treks, all of the space pictures, they were kind of loaded. But I think it's more selective now. I remember, if you've ever seen some of those early black-and-white comedies, there's always something going on in the background. In fact, in the Laurel and Hardy comedies, there's always something just beyond your ear that's going on, and I don't know whether they felt that the comedians couldn't sustain it without it, but it was just a way of working. But now, it's people are listening too. You have to be careful that you don't get in the way of the picture, because there are a lot more people that are fans of movie music, and not only the rock music that we have in our pictures, but for dramatic underscore.
What do you do when you're scoring? Do you watch the sequence over and over again until you really get a sense of its rhythm?
Well, the first thing I do, I love to see, I think it's very necessary to see the picture in a big room, in a big theater, not necessarily with a lot of people, but a big screen in a screening room. Then after I've got that out of the way, they let me have a video cassette, VHS. And that's only recent. I've only been doing that for about the last 5, 6, 7 years. But that's a big help, because I can sit there with the remote and go back and forth and really get involved in the screen.
Do you like to read the script beforehand, or do you just wait till
sometimes
you get
the film? Sometimes I get in where long after the script is gone. Many pictures I've done where I have not read the script because I wasn't called in until the picture was finished, and then the script is useless.
You know, since American Graffiti, a lot of movies have had records as the soundtrack, and then there's a soundtrack album that's basically a collection of already produced records. Is that kind of soundtrack helping to put composers out of business in Hollywood?
Well, someone has to do it, and I guess the songwriters would be considered composers too. That's not a problem with me. It's just the natural curve of the business, the way the film industry is going. You know, something about, I was just thinking, in The Glass Menagerie, it was about 1940, you know, the period.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have gone the route of using songs of the period. You know what I mean? Things that other pictures have done that before. Many pictures have done that for the nostalgia, you know. But in thinking it through, I said, now, this is a very sensitive project here, this Tennessee Williams play. And I think that in order to capture the period, we must do it by music that sounds like the period, rather than something that's going to take the viewer away from their thoughts about the movie. You see, when they're playing an old tune, automatically your mind is a very wondrous thing.
You mean like what was I doing back in 1940?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying, and I didn't want that to happen, and I knew it would, because it does. You know, no matter if you're looking at a picture and it's like hearing an old friend, and it kind of takes you away from the business at hand, which is trying to understand and appreciate what's going up on the screen.
You're still working for television also. Recent themes include the Newhart theme, Remington Steele, NBC News election coverage. Is television more demographic-oriented than it used to be? Do they tell you the market that they want, the age group they want to reach when they tell you to write a theme, and they ask you to write a theme?
No, that hasn't come up, but I think that's something that, you know, all the things that you just mentioned now, the Remington Steele, Newhart, and Hotel, you have to go for what those pictures are about. And then, none of them are the closest one that comes to any kind of a rock feeling is Remington Steele. And that the rhythm in that kind of harks to that kind of music. But I listen to the title gives me the clue there, and the way it goes, it goes. I feel if it hits the right mood, like Hotel is certainly not a demographic theme. I don't think it's harmonies are involved, and its melody spins off and this way and that way, which is the exact opposite of Top 40 radio. So I think you have to go for saying what you're going to see in after the theme is over.
I want to ask you about another song that you wrote that's become a standard. And I'm thinking of Moon River, which was the theme from Breakfast at Tiffany's. You've written more scores than you have songs, I think that's fair to say. You're going to correct that?
Yes, no.
Oh, okay. No. So tell me what you were thinking about when you wrote that song.
Well, you hit a good point there. All of the songs, just practically all of the songs that I have had written or were popular and are popular now, came out of dramatic situations from the movie. In other words, I didn't sit down to write Moon River as a popular song. In fact, I don't think I could do that. I wouldn't know where to start. I have to have something to react to, and therefore all of the songs are actually themes that came out of the various films.
What are some of the strangest places you've heard your songs or themes played?
Oh, goodness. I was in Osaka once, and we were doing concerts. And we went to have something to eat after the concert, and we went up to this place. It was like the Top of the Mark or something like that. And they had a piano player came in, and he didn't know we were there at all. He didn't know I was there. And I could see him right now. He's a little, kind of little guy. Had a pinstripe suit. He looked like a hitman for the mafia. And he came in, and he sat down, and the first thing he started playing was Moon River. And he had, it's a simple song, you know, you can play it all on the white keys, and you get off in great shape. But he proceeded to put some exotic harmonies in there. Well, no, exotic's not the right word. Wrong harmonies. And by the time he was finished, we were literally couldn't contain ourselves. My bass player, Abe Laboriel, was over there, and he had slid off the chair under the table because these are musical jokes, you know. And to hear something that, like, we just finished playing with the orchestra on the stage, and then to hear this guy come and do a version that was really unorthodox. things like that, the funny things are great, you know.
Do you hear your music performed in restaurants and elevators and things like that?
Oh, I hope so. I think, you know, that's a good place to be. That shows that the songs are well known and that people will accept them.
Have you ever turned around to someone and said, "Hey, buddy, I wrote that song"?
No, not that I can remember. You know, no.
Oh, one last thing. Did you ever want to lead a jazz band or write for orchestras, you know, for the symphony hall, instead of writing film music?
Well, it's come around, I've done it all. I've done all of that that you've mentioned. I've done pieces for concert halls, and I've done the jazz big band albums when I was recording for RCA. So I've managed to hit all the bases.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Have you been to see the Glass Menagerie yet?
Oh yeah, I'm going to London next week. I have a concert with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and I'm going to see the picture over there again. They're having a premiere, so I'm looking forward to that.
So does it look really different with the music?
Oh yes. Yes. The music does help, you know.
Yes, I know. Thank you for speaking with us. My guest has been composer Henry Mancini, and his latest project is the score for the new film The Glass Menagerie, directed by Paul Newman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Brendan Gill, who's written about drama and architecture for The New Yorker. His new book is a biography of Frank Lloyd Wright, so I hope you can join us. This is the title theme from the new film The Glass Menagerie, composed by Henry Mancini.
Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with adventure writer Tim Cahill. Competence and courage are not his strengths, but he does okay grabbing poisonous sea snakes in the Philippines and tracking grizzlies in Montana. His new collection of articles is titled Jaguars Ripped My Flesh. Also today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new reissue of a 1960 recording of Tchaikovsky's Last Three Symphonies. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses the semantic shell games of automakers and airlines. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Federal Appeals Court Judge Anthony Kennedy was named by President Reagan today as the president's nominee to the Supreme Court. Mr. Reagan praised Kennedy as a tough judge and a true conservative. Kennedy underwent 10 hours of questioning from the FBI and said he would answer fully all the questions put to him by the Senate Judiciary Committee. He said he looks forward to serving on the High Court.
I share with you, Mr. President, and with each member of the Senate, an abiding respect for the Supreme Court, for the confirmation process, and for the Constitution of the United States, which we are all sworn to preserve and to protect.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the nomination would not be formally sent to the Senate until the FBI completes its background check. Leading Senate Democrats have promised to move as quickly as possible with Kennedy's confirmation hearings once the nomination is received. Nicaraguan leader Daniel Ortega restated that his government will comply with the Central American peace agreement, but he did not announce direct negotiations with the Contras. Instead, he again called for negotiations with intermediaries. Speaking through a translator at the Organization of American States headquarters in Washington, Ortega called the Contras sons of Reagan and again demanded direct negotiations with Washington.
We are waiting. We are waiting for President Reagan to keep his word and that he will begin to undertake a direct dialogue, government to government, between Nicaragua and the United States.
Contra leader Adolfo Calero sat in on Ortega's speech. He called it boring and without any real substance. In the Soviet Union, an official who had complained that the pace of reform was too slow is no longer in his job. Boris Yeltsin had been the Moscow party boss and a protege of Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's. Gorbachev apparently was at the meeting today where Yeltsin's removal was announced. Foreign analysts of Soviet affairs say Yeltsin was the most outspoken supporter of reform in the Kremlin. When Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev comes to the U.S. next month for the summit, he might stay a few extra days. That word today from unnamed sources at the White House, where American and Soviet officials met to make plans. Today in the Beirut airport, a bomb blast in a busy departure area, the BBC's Jim Muir reports.
The forecourt in front of the airport terminal's main entrance was crowded with people seeing off departing relatives or friends when the bomb exploded. It had been planted in a suitcase, and some accounts, including that of Beirut Radio, said it was being carried by a woman who was among those who died in the blast. Syrian troops, who've been in control of the Beirut airport area since February and have a major base there, swiftly sealed off approach roads, turning back reporters and photographers. The airport had only reopened on Tuesday after being shut down for 5 days by a general strike, which paralyzed most activities both in Beirut and elsewhere in Lebanon in protest at the country's economic crisis. But despite the explosion, the airport's director said that flights in and out of the country were continuing as normal. The motives for the bombing are far from clear, but there have been numerous explosions in West Beirut and at Tripoli in northern Lebanon since the Syrian troops took control of security in those areas. And the general assumption has been that most, if not all, of the attacks have been aimed at undermining and discrediting the Syrian role.
The BBC's Jim Muir. The nation saluted its veterans today. In the northeast, snow forced the cancellation of a number of parades and events. But at Arlington National Cemetery, the ceremony took place despite a driving snowstorm. Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And White House and congressional budget negotiators today said they are optimistic about reaching agreement by the end of the week on deficit reductions. You're listening to National Public Radio News. I'm Mara Liasson in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, says the music of Tchaikovsky often lends itself to overindulgent performances by sentimental conductors. But Lloyd has found a new compact disc reissue of Tchaikovsky's 4th, 5th, and 6th symphonies by the Russian conductor Yevgeny Mravinsky. Lloyd says this recording sticks to the more restrained and elegant scores that Tchaikovsky wrote and sounds better for it.
The first classical music I ever loved was Tchaikovsky. The unforgettable tunes, the grand sweep, and probably even the romantic melancholy were just what I thought music should be. Then I learned better. Tchaikovsky was sentimental, melodramatic, definitely not sophisticated or for sophisticated tastes. Mozart was the greatest genius, Bach the most magnificent and spiritual. Beethoven, especially the late string quartets, music at its most exalted and profound. Some moderns were also okay, Stravinsky and the Viennese school, even Mahler and Debussy, as long as you liked them for the right reasons. That was the beginning of my musical education. But after years of being embarrassed by my earlier tastes, I started listening to Tchaikovsky again. After all, even Stravinsky loved Tchaikovsky and actually wrote a ballet, The Fairy's Kiss, using Tchaikovsky themes. I was also learning to distinguish good performances from bad. A friend played me Toscanini's recording of the Romeo and Juliet overture, which I was ashamed to admit had once been my favorite piece of music. But suddenly it wasn't just the saccharine theme song for 100 soupy movies, but a dazzling, elegantly fleet, and extraordinarily moving new score. A revelation. The same thing happened again with Tchaikovsky's last three symphonies when I heard about, and then heard, the famous 1960 Yevgeny Mravinsky recordings with the Leningrad Philharmonic. I could hear in the music not Tchaikovsky's heart's blood dripping down his sleeve, but the dark courage and toughness of the Russian character. No wallowing in self-pity, but backbone, a tensile mixture of power and suppleness. Deutsche Grammophon has just issued them on CDs, and they hold up brilliantly. Listen to some of the elegant Andante Cantabile from the Fourth Symphony.
Thank you.
Mravinsky gets some eloquent playing out of the Leningrad Philharmonic in these Tchaikovsky symphonies, actually a lot closer to Toscanini's nobility and refinement than to the usual pseudo-Slavic excesses and distortions. The cantabile or canzone movements really sing, passionately yet with a rare tenderness. Even the grand climaxes have an elasticity of inflection that sounds more like someone speaking than someone making a speech. Like Toscanini in his recording of the Pathetique, Mravinsky gives the march a ferocious yet lilting concision, and the slow finale, marked Adagio Lamentoso, a philosophical weight. Mravinsky injects all the loneliness and melancholy with a certain stoic reticence, almost like Sibelius, but warmer, more open-hearted. The music may be autobiographical, but it's not merely autobiography. Tchaikovsky's lament is for all of us. In his commitment to conducting the scores as written, Mravinsky, like Toscanini, restores to Tchaikovsky his dignity as a composer.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed the new Deutsche Grammophon reissue of Tchaikovsky's 4th, 5th, and 6th symphonies with conductor Yevgeny Mravinsky. You're listening to Fresh Air. Jaguars ripped my flesh. Sounds like it could be a headline from a men's adventure magazine from the 50s. In fact, it's the tongue-in-cheek title of a new collection of travel and adventure essays written by my guest, Tim Cahill. For the past 10 years, he's written a monthly column for Outside Magazine. During that time, he swum in shark-infested waters off Australia, searched the jungles of South America for lost Inca villages, tracked gorillas in Africa, kayaked amid the icebergs off the Alaska coast, and flown into the eye of a hurricane. You'd expect Cahill to be the fearless adventurer, but he swears that competence and courage constantly elude him. Cahill says he inspires others to realize their own fantasies because they know they could do no worse out there than he did.
Most people, I think, in some of the situations that I've found myself, that sadistic knee-slapping editors have suggested that I do, would in fact terrify most people. And I'm their surrogate in the field. I'm the guy that gets to be terrified for your general reader.
Adventure writing used to be the domain of men's magazines. Did you ever read those magazines?
I looked at those magazines 20 years ago when I was a teenager, and generally thought that they had they pretty much bore the same relation to reality that professional wrestling does. It might be entertaining to read a story entitled, say, "A Wolverine is Eating My Leg," or "A Giant Ape is Tearing the Town Apart." But in general, you thought that these things never really happened. It occurred to me that if you just so much as saw a great white shark, and you could write about the terror that you felt, and maybe a little bit of the wonder at the core of that terror, then that would be enough. You didn't have to make up a story about pulling out a penknife and battling this 2,000-pound great white shark for about 2 hours.
What's an example of a time when you've actually risked your life?
I don't think any of these things are extremely risky. You calculate the basic odds on your survival. For instance, last year, a group of friends went and threw a rope off the top of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. By some accounts, it's the highest unbroken cliff in the world. About a half a mile drop straight down. We had a half a mile of rope, a little longer actually, and we climbed up that rope, camped on the top for a day, and then slid back down. It sounds terribly risky when you're not right there doing it. I keep coming back to the shark things because people are terrified of sharks, but I mean, if you're going shark diving with someone who's showing you how to do it, and he's been doing it for 20 years, one of the first things you do is check and see, does this guy have all his arms and legs? And if he does, he probably knows how to dive with sharks, and he can show you how. And he can show you how to do it relatively safely.
Nevertheless, there must have been times when you've said to yourself, if I survive this, I'm quitting. This is too dangerous.
I said that the other day.
Why? What happened?
What we did is we drove a truck from the tip of South America to Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, which is the farthest place north that you can drive in an attempt to set a Guinness Book of Records record. I'm writing a book for it. I think it's a high-speed travelogue that I was doing. But along the way, we kept getting stopped by police in the middle of the night. And it's human beings are by far the most terrifying, more terrifying than sharks or mountains. When a group of men in fatigues and Uzis pull you over in the middle of the night, and you notice that two or three of them seem very nervous and they're 17 years old, and they want to see your papers right now, that's pretty terrifying. I said, well, no, never again, but I've said that before, too.
Well, Tim, let me ask you this. When you've succeeded in climbing a mountain and then getting down from it, or when you've spent a day caving, you've spent the day going through pretty dangerous caves and you've managed to get in and get out without getting too lost, do you feel a certain physical difference? Is there a physical rush, an adrenaline rush after that?
Yes, and during it as well, but you don't notice it as well. You don't notice it while it's happening so much. You notice that the time slows down. You notice that the world takes on a somewhat, colors are brighter. The lines take on a harder edge. And yes, the afterwash of that is a kind of euphoria and a bit of peace as well.
So do you think you've become an adventurer because of the great physical surge that you feel after you've taken a risk and survived?
I think so. And I hate to admit it, but I think that there's a little bit of adolescent fantasy life going on here. Luckily for me, a number of magazines and book companies have agreed to pay me to do these things, to realize these adolescent fantasies. I get to delay growing up a little bit.
What's an example of one of the fantasies you had as a child that you've actually been able to live out?
As a 15 or 16-year-old, I saw my life as a person who lived in a beautiful rural setting and got to go out and travel and have glamorous adventures. As it is, I live in a beautiful town in Montana, and people pay me to go out and have adventures, which the reality of them isn't nearly as glamorous as I'd suppose. But I came pretty close.
You know, I figure that you maybe started your adventure writing as the surrogate for a lot of clumsy people who would have liked to be going on adventures but couldn't really do it. But I figure by this time, you're probably not that clumsy and you're probably not a wimp in the field anymore. You're a real veteran. You must really know what you're doing now.
Sometimes. but you see, I have to write about it. A different sport or something that I haven't done.
Is this your dirty secret that you've become really good at this?
I think you've pegged me. Yeah. No, there's some things that I'm actually pretty good at. Others that I will remain inept at throughout time because I choose to. For instance, I am lousy with a map and a compass. I'm always lost. But it occurs to me that's when the adventure occurs.
You know, everyone here on Fresh Air thought that I should take a moment to swap stories with you. I can, for instance, tell you about the time last night, for instance, when I walked 2 blocks to my car. And, you know, it was chilly. The temperature had dropped 10 degrees in 1 hour.
Well, you were in a serious survival situation.
Are you impressed?
Yeah, I am impressed. I mean, one of the most difficult things that I've ever tried to do is cash an out-of-town check in New York on a Sunday.
Oh, dear. You know, at this point, do you think that you're going on expeditions to give you material to write about, or are you writing as a way to finance your expeditions?
No, I'm pretty adamant about it. The writing comes first, and at this stage in my career also, the money's in my pocket before I walk out the front door.
So what's your next expedition? Where are you off to next?
I'm doing a story for a travel magazine. I'm doing a story about the nightclubs of Tokyo. It could be fierce. I'm a little apprehensive about this one.
Well, have a good trip. Thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Tim Cahill's new book, Jaguars Ripped My Flesh, is published by Bantam. Cahill's essays regularly appear in Outside Magazine. He spoke to us from KEMC in Billings, Montana. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry is co-hosting the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
The Reagan administration has selected Judge Anthony Kennedy to be the next nominee to the Supreme Court. The administration has finally chosen someone who we've expected all week. Also, the Nicaraguan president, Daniel Ortega, spoke here in Washington at the Organization of American States meeting. Arguments continue between the Nicaraguan government and the Reagan administration. 100 years of the National Geographic Society. We have a report tonight. And radio in Vietnam of 25 minutes of some very extraordinary sounds.
Do you have tapes of actual broadcasts?
We have tapes of enemy broadcasts, broadcasts of armed forces broadcasts. Radio was very important in Vietnam.
Thanks, John. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As consumers, we often end up with products and services that have been advertised as one thing, but really turn out to be something else. Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says that businesses have come up with some pretty shifty ways to use our language.
Here's a riddle I heard from my friend Lucky Danker, age 6. Why is a pony like a man with a cold? Because they're both a little hoarse. Lucky thinks this is extremely droll because he has just reached the age when he can see through the faulty logic that these riddles depend on. He's begun to realize that words can sometimes be treacherous to reality, that to be named the same and to be the same are different things. Yet in subtle ways, this treachery of names can still fool us if we're not on our guard. Here's one example I ran into just recently. You can now fly from Paris to San Francisco on what the post-regulation airline industry calls a direct flight. Of course, you'll have to stop in New York, pick up your bags and take them through customs, then recheck them for the second leg, which departs from another terminal with another crew and another airplane, what the airlines call an equipment change. And if you wanted to get literal-minded about things, you might ask why these two separate trips should be considered parts of a single direct flight at all. But the airline has an answer. Both legs have the same name, or in this case, a number, TWA Flight 803, Paris to San Francisco with a stop in New York. This can create some confusion. If the inbound leg is late, you may find TWA Flight 803 leaving New York for San Francisco before it's arrived there from Paris. But in general, the device has proven so effective as a marketing tool that the airlines will often assign several numbers to a single leg, each of which corresponds to a different one of the connecting flights it meets up with. So you can now have four direct flights to four different cities leaving in the same airplane at the same time from the same gate at the same airport, all through the miracle of language. But the airlines are Johnny-come-latelys at this name game. The automobile industry has been exploiting it for 60 years or so, ever since Alfred P. Sloan first realized that you could slap an old name on a new car and sell it as this year's model. Take the series of Ford-built cars called the Capri. For a long time, the name Capri was assigned to whatever sports coupe was being sold by Lincoln Mercury dealers. At first, this was a German import. Then in 1976, the Lincoln Mercury dealers tacked the name Capri onto a totally different car, which was basically what Ford dealers sold as the Mustang. Apparently, there were a lot of people who were quite willing to believe that the pre-76 German Capri and the post-76 American Capri were the same car, even though they had different bodies, different mechanical parts, and were made in different countries. I recall hearing a car salesman tout the 76 Capri as a great improvement over the previous year's model, which was sort of like saying that you'd improved your wife's temperament by divorcing her and marrying somebody else. There ought to be a law, I suppose, except that the lawmakers themselves are up to their larynxes in the same semantic shell games. Here's another riddle. What's the difference between tax increases and revenue enhancements? Answer, in the House of Representatives, about 40 votes. In the end, it's only our own skeptical attentiveness that can keep us from being snookered. As W.H. Auden wrote in his poem Kairos and Logos, one notices, if one will trust one's eyes, the shadow cast by language upon truth.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with British film director John Borman. His new film, Hope and Glory, is based on his childhood memories of the bombing of London in World War II. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new solo album by Robbie Robertson, formerly the lead guitarist and singer with the band. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Cry Freedom, the story of white South African journalist Donald Woods and his friendship with Stephen Biko, the black leader who died in police custody. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.